morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
So there's a federal hiring freeze in effect, but it does not apply to the Pearl Harbor shipyard. Is that right?
So says the Department of Defense. But that, while it sounds like it could be a sigh of relief for example, the shipyard, there are other issues. We're going to talk about that this morning. Now, there are jobs available. As we just mentioned, the hiring freeze does not apply, and there's a Honolulu Community College program to train skilled workers. So how come it's so tough for the Pearl Harbor shipyard to reach full employment? We called the union which represents the shipyard workers to find out why the situation that started with additional worry over necessary jobs going wanting is really a larger conversation that has little to do with the hiring freeze. Robert Lillis is president of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. He's in our studio this morning. Thank you so much for coming in.
Hello, Beth Ann. It's nice to be here. One of the things I want to make clear is I'm one of 10 labor unions at the shipyard. We have an umbrella organization called the Metal Trades Council. But going back to your question, why is it hard to hire so many people? The reason is the shipyard is very specialized in it primarily does submarine work. And submarine work is very technically driven.
It's dirty work, too.
It's very tough work. These boats are very tight. They're filled with some of the most technically advanced technology around. And they're cramped. They operate in some of the toughest environments in the world, under the water. I mean, in every corner of the oceans. And these boats have a lifespan of over 20 years. So in that period of time, the Navy runs them hard. And the maintenance demands that the Navy wants a high-quality ship back from to the fleet from the shipyard. And it takes quality workers, quality work procedures, and quality training.
Yeah, people who know what they're doing.
Absolutely.
When we hear that there were about 500 jobs going wanting that could have been in jeopardy because of the hiring freeze, it sounds like, although those are a lot of jobs, I mean, people kind of jump to that idea. But the idea that it also takes a number of years to get through the program, you're talking 4 years to get through that program, there could be, for example, months before you are actually employed after you get out of the program. That's a lot of time for somebody to change his or her mind about wanting to be involved with the shipyard, and also not necessarily accounting for the attrition that you're feeling anyway.
Yeah, okay. The process of getting hired into the shipyard is quite cumbersome, but a lot of it's necessary. There's security clearances you have to pass.
Well, these are federal employees.
Yes. But it's more than your regular federal employee. There's an exclusive feeling being for the shipyard employee that they're part of a tight community, that there's only 4 naval shipyards in the nation, and Pearl Harbor is one of them. It's one of the smaller of the 4 shipyards. It has a very stoic history of being a place where the aircraft carriers in the Battle of Midway were repaired in unbelievable speed, and that's something we take a historic pride on. And it's a good place for people to work. It is a good job, and good jobs are becoming harder and harder to find. It's also a skilled trade. You know, our welders at the shipyard that we represent, our machinists, our mechanics, take years to become a full qualified journeyman mechanic. And that's something they take pride in, the quality of work they take pride in.
Has there ever been a point where you've had enough people coming into the pipeline and also enough people coming out to fill the jobs as other people are retiring and as the necessity has increased for those skilled workers?
If you're talking about has there been a time when we had the right numbers, there was a time in the early 80s where the shipyard was a little bit overmanned and they had a reduction of force at that time. And that was a painful experience to see so many people with good jobs having to lose their jobs at the shipyard, something that many people had. And this was a while ago, back in the 80s. But since then, the shipyard has been a very steady hire. It's been a good job for people to get. It's steady employment.
But has there been a point where you've had full employment, where you've had the amount of people that you needed to do the job with alacrity in the way that, you know, the Navy wants it done, and to feel that you weren't having to burden people with extensive overtime to be able to get it done.
Right now, we're running a lot. There is a lot of overtime being run. We're trying to make up the numbers by hiring enough people. The exact number, it's a variable number that you'd be chasing, because the amount of work that the Navy ships need varies each time a ship comes in. It's not a consistent. The people who are running the shipyard are very good at doing an estimate on how much manpower they need, and they tend to calculate low. They want to not do a reduction in force, so they usually want to have a minimum employees and make it up on the overtime. It's a lot less painful for the workforce to let people go as painful.
Nevertheless, you've got a lot of work that you have to get done. And yeah. So now if you're having to defer to overtime, what would be the minimum amount of people that you would need today to be able to get the jobs that are currently under contract?
I think the number of 500 is a valid number to bring up the shipyard to where it needs to be, and that needs to be done in increments. It can't be done all at once.
What's the time period that you would see that could happen, and are there really truly enough people, again, coming into the pipeline, coming out of the pipeline now, that would fill those jobs for you in the near term?
Well, they hired about over 100 apprentices this year, and I believe the process will be about the same for next year. And in a couple of years, we should be able to make up for the losses there.
And what about the attrition factor, and also people who are simply, retiring?
Yeah, there's yes, we have to make up for the attrition and retirement. So you can't just hire exactly what you need. You have to anticipate you're going to lose some. I believe that the apprentice class has about a 5% attrition rate, about 5% of the people. So if you hire 100, five people after the end of 4 years will probably not be there. It's low, but it's still real. And that builds up, a 5% here and 5% there, and all of a sudden you don't have enough people and you're having to make it up with either backing up your schedule or a lot of overtime, or sometimes both overtime and backing up your schedules.
As you looked at the hiring freeze, which now, according to the DOD, doesn't apply to the shipyards, but even at first blush, was that a mistake?
I think it was short-sighted, because you can't, I don't represent just Pearl Harbor, represent federal workers in various other places such as Tripler and private sector workers such as BA Hawaii Shipyard. Now, these are all good workers, good paying jobs. Now, when you don't hire and you have work to do, you either have to make it up on overtime or defer the work, or your schedule slips. And none of those are really good things. So the hiring freeze was short-sighted at best.
I want to thank you for coming in this morning and being with us.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
We'll see what happens. Robert Lillis is president of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. It's The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, Hawaii novelist looks at hard facts of recent history. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
Umau, ukaho olabe, o Hawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about one of Hawaii's most ubiquitous flora. The former whaling town and one-time capital city of Hawaii is host to one of the largest banyan trees in the nation. And host would be the operative word. The banyan is also a parasitic fig that latches onto and takes over a host tree. Over time, it creates canopies of shade, and on Lahaina's front street, the massive banyan tree across from the courthouse shades an entire city block. Its canopy stretches over two-thirds of an acre, allowing strollers to browse through art and craft shows every other weekend under the leaves. The tree's height matches its breadth in proportions. From trunk base to leafy treetop, it measures almost 60 feet in height. So to hold up all that greenery, its trunk has to be enormous, and just one trunk won't do. For our backyard quiz today, can you tell us the number of trunks that hold the Lahaina banyan tree upright? We'll give you bonus points if you can tell us how many birthdays the front street marvel has celebrated. If you know, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Start counting. We'll be back with the answer later in the show.
Hey, good morning. My name is Jeff Geer, and I'm here to tell you some spooks. A little bit of story. Yeah, so here's a scoop. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show by going to hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation. Got it?
Mike Bond is a Hawaii-based novelist who uses the art of fiction to take us behind the headlines based on his experience as a world-traveled journalist. His latest novel is called Assassin, and it looks at what he sees as decades of policy decisions and mistakes that fueled the rapid growth of ISIS. He's on the line with us from Molokai. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Chris. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks for talking with us. This war on terrorism is a strange thing. It reminds me of the Greek myth where you slay one and two rise up.
Exactly. Right on. Yep, it's a real mess, Chris.
Well, I mean, messes like this don't come about overnight, right?
No, we all have been working on this for many years. And, actually about 1,000 years.
Yeah, I was starting to sort of work backwards, and the first place you work backwards to is probably the post First World War partition. Yep. Of the Middle East, right?
Yes, the Sykes-Picot agreements, which basically partitioned, as you said, the Middle East in ways that French and UK diplomats decided might be fun, but had no relationship to anything on the ground.
Yeah, these straight lines that make no sense, right?
But actually, it goes all. I mean, the war has been a central part of history in the Middle East for probably 10,000 years. It's the Garden of Eden. It's where, when we came out of Africa, we found the climate and everything else most appealing. And it certainly went into high gear with the evolution of Islam in the 600s, which became immediately an enormously conquering expansionist religion, if you wish. And so Islam, over the next 200 years, spread extremely fast across North Africa, throughout the Middle East, and even into Europe. And it's been a battle since between the West and Islam in many ways, which, as you pointed out, was heightened by the partitioning after World War One of the Middle East, and then, of course, all of the rip-offs associated with the oil industry and all those wars. And then, I mean, there's so many things. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Mike, what got us on this latest path to being the great Satan we have become in the eyes of so many?
Well, it's certainly, I mean, so many things we did, and this isn't one-sided. I think it's important to however, mention the things where we've gone wrong. When we overthrew the legally democratically elected government of Iran in 1954 and installed the Shah, which led, of course, a few 20 years or so later to the Ayatollahs and all the Islamic fanaticism that has come out of Iran since then, Hezbollah. And we hired a Baghdad thug named Saddam Hussein to shoot the Iraqi prime minister, shot himself in the foot instead, but we still made Saddam the dictator of Iraq. We changed dictators and governments over there frequently. And even as the president said recently, we do kill people. And it killed many people in Iraq and assassinated. So,
you know what, the complexities of history aren't easily digested by a great many members of the reading audience, even maybe as much as they should be. And certainly, you know, the recent rise of ISIS and the things that led to it have been written about by some very good nonfiction writers, but. Why is historical fiction, you know, why is genre fiction like this especially? I think it's especially effective, and obviously you do too, but why?
Well, that's a really good question, Chris. And the reason why, as I see it, is first of all, what I try to do in my books is to put people right there. I want my reader to feel what it's like to be there, to be in the middle of combat or be in the middle of a CIA decision. I want them to understand emotionally. I want it to be an emotional response to a situation, and I also very strongly want them to know the truth. I mean, today, there's no way we can understand the truth from the situation we're in. And what I try to do is to tell both sides. My dedication is to our servicemen and women. That's my primary dedication. But I don't want to see them endangered or killed for no reason. I want us to get down to the meat of the reality of this so that we all understand what's happened emotionally.
Well,
I'm explaining that poorly. I'm sorry.
No, I don't think you are at all, Mike, because what you're getting at is understanding the truth through a work of fiction. And you know, the convention of good historical fiction is that when you refer to that the external reality of your characters has to be accurate. Is that the rule that you're following?
Yeah, you have to know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. So when you allude to an event or any kind of circumstance, it's documentable, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Or I've been there myself. Mm-hmm. And much of this book is my own personal experience over the last 30 years. And so... When I talk about a firefighter at an intersection of the street somewhere in some Middle East town, I may very well have been there, depending on which one and where. So again, Chris, this is back to I'm trying to bring the readers, my fellow Americans, the people I care most about, into the absolute truth of this situation so that we can make the right decisions. Because if we don't know the truth, we can't possibly make the right decisions.
Absolute truth is an awful high bar to set, Mike.
Yep. That's the only one that matters, though, Chris, really. You know, I open the book Assassins with a quotation from The Art of War, and basically, to summarize it, it's he who knows neither himself nor his enemy is sure to be defeated.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think in the past 30 years with Islam that we've known ourselves very well, and we certainly haven't known the enemy. That's what I'm trying to rectify in this book, Assassins.
We can look at other conflicts that haven't worked out well for the U.S. and say the same thing about them, couldn't we?
Vietnam is a perfect example.
It's what popped into my head, Mike.
Yeah. And I think if we don't learn from these kinds of historical events, then we're doomed to repeat them, as we all know. And my goal is that we don't repeat these things. My goal is that we understand this deeply so we can make wise decisions.
Makes sense to me, Mike. Thanks very much for talking with us. I appreciate it.
Well, I very much appreciate it. And anybody who would like to read Assassins, I think it's at the Barnes & Noble in Ala Moana, and it's also available anywhere on Amazon.
Terrific. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Bond.
Is the author of Assassins, released in January of this year from Mandevilla Press. He lives on Molokai, and you can learn more about his books on our Facebook page.
American ideal with questionable origins.
When I say that these enlightened liberal Americans believed in the equality, potential inequality of people of color, they believed in their potential to become like white people.
A historian reveals the seeds of segregation in early America. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
I'm Shauna Tonkin from the Pacific Aviation Museum, Pearl Harbor. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Funds to build new affordable units just aren't enough, according to one lawmaker, and it's why Senator Willis Sparrow wants to float general obligation bonds to meet the housing shortage. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Before the session opened, Senator Sparrow was on the program to talk about this bill, but before we get to it, let's consider for a moment what affordable means. Really, who are we talking about when we're talking about people who need affordable housing? What price point and what salary level are we talking about?
It might actually surprise people, because just here on Oahu, the average home is going for $760,000. Last time I checked, and I think it's less so on the neighbor islands, not in some neighborhoods, but that's a whole lot of money. It may also surprise people what that income bracket is that qualifies you to get this affordable housing. More than 80% of the people that will be needing housing are making, if you're an individual, about $98,000. Can you imagine that? That's something you'd think with $98,000 a year, you'd be able to afford something. Or if you're a family of four, it's $140,000. So Willis Sparrow says we need to think big. And boy, is he thinking big. This bond that he wants to float is for $2 billion, B as in boy, to address the housing shortage.
When we talk about the kind of money that you just mentioned, you know, almost $100,000 a year if you're a single person, $140,000 if you're a family of four. I mean, anywhere else practically in the country, that would get you a very nice home indeed, and you'd be feeling like you were really, truly part of the middle class and doing well in your life. But here, given the numbers that we know we have to make to be able to afford a house that's just a median price, this seems to be the part of the question that we're really not asking ourselves in terms of how many units do we need at this level and how many units do we need at the level of low-income affordable housing, because it all seems to get lumped in together, you know?
Right, exactly. Well, in terms of what the people need, the numbers, the estimate for those in that bracket that we're talking about, the income bracket, we're talking 24,500 people over the next 5 years. And we should tell you that the state is not on pace to be anywhere near close to that, even though that is the commitment. There's a serious problem in meeting this housing crisis. And as others have pointed out, you haven't noticed the homelessness crisis has increased as well, and they are definitely connected. Now, the legislature is taking it seriously. Sparrow has 20 of his 25 colleagues on board for this, but in the House, not so much. He's only got one House co-sponsor, Tom Brower, who says maybe this is unrealistic. In the meantime, Governor Ige is looking at floating his own bonds, or the state's bonds, $1.5 billion. Mm-hmm. But there's a concern about how the revenue forecast is going to be. As you know, it's been downgraded recently by the council.
So, I mean, at this point, the need is ever growing. The fact that we're talking about middle income and upper middle income, as well as, you know, low income issues that are tied back to homelessness. Isn't this just, you know, snowballing every year we forestall it?
It is, and that's why Willis Sparrow says we really need to do this now. In fact, one real estate analyst that our reporter, Anita Hofschneider, talked to said look, this is the first serious attempt in a decade to try and deal with this. The money, by the way, would go to both for sale and rental housing. It would go to public housing repairs, and it would also go to homeless shelters. But Anita talked to a lot of people, mostly on board with this, saying this is kind of a big, I keep using that word big, but it is a big crisis, and we need a big solution. We'll see whether this bill makes it.
Exactly. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair joins us daily from Civil Beat with a reality check. On your list of predictors of crime, you might call out poverty, alcohol, and drug abuse. A recent Harvard and Northwestern University study would add domestic violence. In the researchers' view, interpersonal violence is the harbinger of more serious crime. Hawaii Island prosecuting attorney Mitch Roth would agree, and it's why he says we need a larger conversation that goes beyond domestic violence as a woman's issue. Mitch Roth joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Aloha. How are you today, Bethann?
Good to talk to you. Why is it that we don't better link the occurrence of domestic violence and crime in a general conversation? Because that includes everybody.
You know, I think you said in the opening, domestic violence oftentimes is seen as a woman's issue. And you know, it came out of the feminist movement. A lot of times when you hear people talking about domestic violence, oftentimes you're hearing women, and a lot of times they're men shaming. We see it at, I've seen it for the last 20 years, when we're seeing these presentations to police officers, and why is this man doing this? Why is all this happening? On the other side, we hear from our jurors, why doesn't she just leave? And, it's a big problem. If you were to learn about domestic violence in a university setting, you'd most likely learn about it in a women's studies course. How many men are going to, women's studies courses? A lot of your officers, a lot of your business owners, they just don't listen to domestic violence as an issue. But it is probably the biggest root of crime that we have in not just Hawaii, but in the United States. When you look at studies, you see that children who come from homes of domestic violence are 6 times more likely to commit suicide. Suicide is one of our big problems that we're having in Hawaii. Kids that come from homes of domestic violence are 50 times more likely to abuse drugs and alcohol. You talk to people about crime in Hawaii or just about any place else, they're going to tell you, well, it's the drugs, it's the alcohol abuse, it's these things. Well, how are we looking at these problems? Why are these people using drugs and alcohol?
Right. You're bringing up the idea that we tend to focus on the symptoms of the problem and not the root cause.
Absolutely.
You know, we do see that men turn out for the men's march, that men around the time of the men's march will talk about this. But what I really hear you saying is that this needs to get off being the men's or women's issue that's being carried and looking at it really narrowly through that lens of the harbinger of crime.
Absolutely.
So how do we do that?
Well, I think you said it right there. We need to focus on what's causing the ills of society. We need to take the medical model. You know, you don't say, oh, we're going to treat this cold by just, treating what happened. You got to be proactive. And, part of that is getting more people involved. It's bringing more people in, bringing in especially more men and more businesses. When I look at domestic violence cases from how it's viewed from law enforcement, most law enforcement officers, they don't, see it as the serious problem that it is. A lot of officers will tell you, oh, they're sick and tired of going back to this place. Why doesn't she just leave? We hear the same thing from jurors and judges sometimes. They don't realize that this is a serious problem.
Even now, Mitch, I mean, where there seems to be such a focus over the last, 2 to 3 years in particular, that the conversation seemed to be moving a little bit. We saw what came out of the legislature last year. I want to talk to you a little bit about what you're seeing this year. But you don't see really any movement in that, and people understanding that this is an issue that needs to be discussed as you know, crime inducing?
I see there has been some progress gained, but not enough. It's like how do you turn a carrier? You know, they turn it very slow with constant pressure, and I think that's what we need to do. We need to keep on focusing on this issue, because there are more people who are understanding what's going on, but not nearly enough. I can tell you, we get deputy prosecutors. I've been a prosecutor on Oahu, and I've been a prosecutor here, and I talk to prosecutors around the state. A lot of times, it's your newer prosecutors that are going through these domestic violence cases and trying to get, you know, experience. And most of them will tell you, we hate doing these cases. Your victims oftentimes will minimize, they'll recant. They're very difficult cases to win, and they're missing the point that these are probably the most important cases that you're going to deal with. When we look at the fatalities in Hawaii, if a woman is killed in Hawaii, there's about a 75% chance that domestic violence is going to be involved in Hawaii.
So how do you then try to reshape the views of those, you know, young prosecuting attorneys that you're seeing come into your office or that you've dealt with in the recent past?
Well, a lot of it's education. We have a lot of things going on Hawaii Island that I'm really proud of the community over here. We have a domestic violence group that meets and discusses different events. We have the Men's March. YWCA puts a walk a mile in her shoes. We have a vigil that goes on. There's a family march. And when we do our marches here in Hilo, at least, we've had a couple hundred people showing up, and a good number of those people have been men. And that's a big change from what we saw, you know, 20 years ago when I came to Hawaii Island. It used to be just one or two guys that were showing up, and now we have several men that are participating. I think that's good, but it's still just not enough, because it's still going on in our communities, and a lot of people say, well, that's not our problem.
Mitch, our time is running a little short, but I didn't hear you list the legislature and any sort of legislative activities in what you just listed as gains that you see. How are you gauging what's going on at the legislature in response to domestic violence in Hawaii?
You know, I think that we have a few of our legislators, especially, and again, where are the domestic violence bills being pushed from? The Women's Caucus, which is kind of interesting. I think we have some legislators are kind of getting the idea that we need to do something about this. There are a couple of bills up that, you know, there's a bill up tomorrow that we're probably not going to be in favor of, but the fact that they're trying to come up with solutions, I think, is a really positive sign that there's hope.
Are you talking about the bill that is related to the streamlining of reporting from the Department of Human Services?
No, actually, I'm talking about a bill that they want to make domestic violence a less serious crime, from a full misdemeanor to a petty misdemeanor. And there's, you know, there's a lot of debate on that. On one side, it will move these cases, because Honolulu has a big problem with these cases having jury trials, and they get wrapped up in the courts, and most of those cases get dismissed or pled down. On the Big Island, we don't have so many jury trials for the DV cases, and things seem to move a little bit quicker over here. The problem with the bill, one of the big problems with the bill, is you're treating women, saying, hey, you know what, you're not as important as the person who was assaulted down the street. That's going to be a full misdemeanor for assaulting someone on the street, but if you assault a woman that you're a partner with, we're going to make that a less serious crime for the first offense. The other thing is, they're trying to do this so they can take it away from the jury trial range, and our Supreme Court may or may not let that happen. In the purpose of the bill, it doesn't say anything about getting rid of jury trials, which is kind of interesting, because that really is the motivation to make it a petty misdemeanor. A lot of times in Hawaii we say it's a petty misdemeanor. It's not a jury tribal offense. However, our Supreme Court looks at jury trials a little bit differently than other courts around the country. And so they may make it a less serious offense, and we still may have to go through jury trials. So there's a lot of problems there, and I think the message it sends also is kind of demeaning to especially women who are victims of domestic violence.
So just to bring this back to the home point, that as we have seen these bills coming through the Women's Legislative Caucus and focusing on this as a women's issue, what do you think has to happen next at a higher level, you know, to be able to elevate that conversation, to bring it back to the way you look at it, which is through the lens of crime?
Well, I think people need to look at, you know, and it needs to be more than a women's issue. It needs to be something that's discussed. So having it on the radio and discussing it on the radio is a great thing. And people need to say, look, we can't just look at the symptoms. We need to go back to the root and find out what's causing all of our crime. If drugs and alcohol are an indicator, we have a domestic violence summit every year where we bring a whole bunch of people. One of the groups we bring in is our drug treatment facilities. And I ask this question every year to the mothers and baby programs. What percent of the women in your program who are there for substance abuse, and substance abuse pretty much only for substance abuse, what percentage of those women have domestic violence in their background? Almost every woman, every time I ask this question, they say it's about 100%, up between 90 and 100%, but it's generally 100%.
And that's a very, very telling statistic. I wish we had more time to delve into that, but bringing it back to the point that this is allied with crime and the incidence of crime in a community that can very well be predicted by the incidence of domestic violence. Thank you very much for this morning.
Thank you very much, and thank you for getting the word out there, because this is really important. It's not just for domestic violence, but for all of the crimes that we're seeing. If we want a safer and healthier community, we have to be educated. And so I thank you for educating our listeners, your listeners.
Mitch Roth is Hawaii County's prosecuting attorney.
In honor of Valentine's Day, entertainer Willow Chang presents an evening of songs she calls The Seven Faces of Love on Saturday, February 11th in the Atherton Studio. They're beloved tunes from Broadway, jazz, pop, and beyond. Treat yourself and a loved one to tickets by calling 955-8821 during business hours or by going to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we paid a visit to one of the largest banyans in the nation. It's also known as a strangling fig, and banyans commandeer the living space of a host tree, and as they grow, so do the banyan's vines, which then mingle and turn into trunks. Long ago, the sheriff of Lahaina planted an 8-foot banyan sapling from India on the town's waterfront. Today, we asked you how many trunks that giant has, and also if you knew how many birthdays it celebrated since it took root by the sea. Well, it was put into the ground to celebrate 50 years of Lahaina Protestant Missionary Ministry. That was on April 24th, 1873. So this year will mark the tree's 144th birthday. For you mathletes, it works out to be one trunk for every 12 years, as Lahaina's Front Street Banyan tree has 12 trunks. Nobody knew the answer today, so we'll keep the prize and see what happens tomorrow. Now, if you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
What kid hasn't wondered at one time or another what makes things fly? The science of aerodynamics has fascinated many of us growing up with our bottle rockets, model and remote-controlled aircraft, and now drones. For some, it's a fascination that never goes away. The Maui Science Center's Launch Lab gives kids and their parents a chance to design and build an aircraft tested in a wind tunnel. Science Center Director Rima Murta is bringing it to Kihei Maui's library this weekend, and she's on the line. Good morning, Rima.
Aloha, Chris.
This is a great idea. How'd you come up with this?
Oh, thank you so much. Maui Science Center is bringing activities for learners of all ages to inspire curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And Launch Lab is actually borrowed from other science centers on the mainland. They have this amazing exhibit called Wind Tubes.
Yeah.
And we had our volunteers who helped us build it. And we had a couple events already where we brought our wind tubes and let the visitors test it, and it was a great success.
What is a wind tube? I'm trying to visualize what a wind tube is. Right?
Wind tube is basically a table with the hole cut up in the middle, and the fan is upside down, blowing up.
Uh-huh.
And then on top of the table, there's a tall tube attached to it. So when you build a paper sculpture or parachute with the recycled materials, you get to test it by basically inserting the sculpture in the tube and see how it flies.
So you kind of basically learn how lift works and how things are kept up in the air, yeah?
Yeah, lift, drag, everything that comes with the aerodynamics.
And the whole complex of things that you have to keep in mind in aerodynamics to fly any kind of aircraft is it's quite a list, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, and this activity is what's interesting. We don't provide much instructions for the activities.
Uh-huh.
We let visitors use their own analytical skills to figure out how it flies or what's going on inside the wind tube. So it's pretty engaging activity.
So you just kind of provide materials and say, go ahead and use these to make something that you think will fly, huh?
Yes, absolutely. And last time we had this event in fall, we were blown away by the designs that children and their parents came up with. It was simply amazing.
Designs that you mean sort of parachute-like designs or...
Yeah, anything. What we bring common recycled materials like paper cups and strings, paper clips, and some paper foils, plastic bags. And, yes, literally, they come up with, it's not just parachutes. It's it's really engineering creations at its best.
It sounds like, in a way, of engineering in its purest form, where you just get some materials and you have a goal and you just sort of figure it out, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
That was,
and possibilities are endless.
Well, it also gets to kind of what is the essence of learning, right? Do you either present all this information or do you just sort of say, here, figure it out? It sounds like this is the second of those options.
Correct. That's exactly what we do. We do have educators who comes to facilitate the activities. So there is some learning involved, and we provide educational posters where if the visitors desire, they can learn more about the aerodynamics and science behind the activity. But for the most part, yes, it's freestyle engineering event.
Well, just the idea of using, when I first was reading about this, I assumed that there'd be far more sophisticated materials involved than, paper towel rolls and pipe cleaners. But the idea, that's part of the whole idea, isn't it, to use things that are readily available?
Yes, absolutely. We would like to inspire this activity so any visitor or participant can go back home and find all the materials and try to recreate the activities by simply turning the fan, facing it up, and try to fly something over. Then last time we had sales car where you just put the fan on the floor or on the table and you try to build a sail, attach it to any general matchbox car.
Sure.
And try to roll it and see how far it would go.
The same, a lot of the same principles would apply to sailing as well, wouldn't they?
Yes. Similar, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. You're also going to build roller coasters? Is that a separate activity?
We have our new exhibit is being built by Maui Makers, and it's basically a pegboard. And again, we get to use common materials like paper rolls. Paper towel rolls or PVC pipes and some pegs and common material. Anyway, and we try to build a roller coaster or marble run, as you would call. Again, it's pretty engaging and exciting.
Sounds
I guess
like
the
fun.
Important part of this activity is that without even realizing, visitors, they start working in groups. Strangers, they don't know each other, but they start working in groups, collaborating, and try to solve problem or come up with a new idea.
That's where the
borrowing ideas from each other.
That's where the real education comes in. Thanks so much for talking with us, Rima.
Thank you for having us.
Rima Murta is the director of the Maui Science Center, and their launch lab is at the Kihei Public Library this Saturday from 10:30 a.m. to noon, suggested for ages 7 to 107. And materials are provided, but recycled materials like paper towel rolls, unused pipe cleaners, paper cups, and aluminum foil would be most welcome.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Scheidler Family Foundation in support of the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the Honolulu African American Film Festival through February 17th. HonoluluMuseum.org.
The suggestion that domestic violence be downgraded to a petty misdemeanor is probably going to raise a few hackles, isn't it?
Well, in that particular case, if it's with your intimate partner. But the
right.
Overall conversation that I think Mitch Roth is trying to have is that we need to look at this as being a predictor of criminality.
Yeah.
That this is not just something that's a woman's issue. It's not something that just affects families, but this affects everybody because it brings crime.
Makes a lot of sense.
And it's a very interesting study, the Harvard and Northwestern study. In any case, we will put that up for you so you can have a look at it too. Now, that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we're going to talk with Eileen Hybe. She's a member of the Board of Advisors for Psychologists Opposed to Prescription Privileges for Psychologists. You can bet what we're going to talk about.
And playwright Annie Cusick-Wood will look at the meaning and value of home in her new play.
Now, we're just 1 week away from moving day. Remember to hit HPR1's preset to catch the conversation. And in our new time slot, that's at 11 o'clock, beginning on Valentine's Day. You can also let us know what you think about guests. On our talk back line, that number is 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to see any of the shows again, you can always look on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vanderkam.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you in the morning for the conversation.